to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Birds, bees, and bonnets. There's a lot to be said for conservation biology. Jen Carpenter is a master's student studying the effect of West Nile virus on the mating success of sage grouse. Her supervisor, Dr. Mark Boyce, is advocating the implementation of access management to reduce the high mortality rate of Alberta's grizzly bears. And ecologist Dr. Fiona Schmigolo is wearing a dozen different hats while she crams as much work as she possibly can into a sabbatical that's taking her from the Yukon to Washington. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. The sage grouse is one of those prairie birds that has long tail feathers, much like those of the pheasant, the feathers that graced many a lady's hat in the 1940s. There aren't too many sage grouse left in Alberta, and now that West Nile virus has moved in, there could be even less. Jen Carpenter is a master's student at the University of Alberta who's studying the connection between sage grouse, their sexual patterns, and West Nile virus.
Well, you find them in southeastern Alberta. In Alberta, in the Minnieberries corner of the province. And if you can think of a grouse, I guess a good way to explain it is it's kind of like a big brown chicken. Like it's a really neat bird. It's sage grouse are the biggest grouse we have in Alberta. And what makes them really neat is that their mating system is telec, so they gather on sort of mating areas, and the males all display to one another, and they have these big yellow air sacs that they poof out, and they make lots of fun blooping noises and wave their wings around and spread out their tails and display to the hens.
What got you interested in sage grouse?
Well, I've been interested in conservation biology. That's what I did my undergraduate degree in for a long time, and I was working on a sage grouse project for a PhD student in this lab, Cam Aldridge. And I guess just through that job, they're a really neat species.
In the work that you were doing with Cam Aldridge, you came across something interesting and surprising about sage grouse. What was that?
When I was working for Cam, we'd find these in sort of the mid-late summer. We started finding hens that we were radio tracking that were just sort of fallen over, and they were still, I guess, intact. And dead, of course, but they hadn't been predated on or eaten by anything like an eagle or anything. And so we thought this was a little bit strange, and we brought them home and put them in the freezer and later had them tested, and it turned out that they were dying of West Nile virus. And that was pretty significant, I guess, because it was at a time of year when usually survival is pretty high. And we were tracking 30-odd birds, and we lost 10 or so of them in a same period of time.
That's not the sort of thing a researcher wants to happen.
No, it's kind of disheartening when you go out in the field and you're out there to, you know, make habitat measurements and you find a carcass. It puts a damper on your day for sure.
So you found that these hens were dying of West Nile virus. Then what?
I continued working for Cam through the winter, and the decision was made that just based on the high mortality in both this population and other populations in the States, that sort of management action had to happen, or this was going to be a really significant stressor on the population. It would push numbers even lower than they are. So last year I worked on a project which was sort of a pilot mosquito vector control project, and the idea was to reduce transmission of West Nile virus in critical parts of sage grouse range. But of course what happened last year was cooler temperatures really disrupted mosquito development. We saw a lot slower mosquito development, and province-wide development of West Nile virus and transmission was much lower, and so we didn't have a single mortality last year, which was really nice. But it sort of got me interested in disease and sage grouse, and disease is important for sage grouse mate selection and sexual selection.
Well, how does that work?
Well, I was explaining earlier that the males gather on these breeding sites or these select sites and display both to each other and to the hens, and then the hens can come and I essentially select a male. It's sort of like if you go to the bar and you're picking out a boy, you're not going to go with the one that's covered in fleas and lice and ticks. You're going to go home with the guy who has nice clean air sacs.
Air sacs?
if you're a female sage grouse, yeah. So what you would expect through time on a lek species, though, if hens are always choosing the best male or the central male, and you would expect them to always pick, you know, the same male, and you would expect eventually all the males in the lek to end up the same, because all the hens are mating with the same characteristics. So pretty soon it wouldn't make a difference which male they picked, because the males would be all the same.
But they're not picking the same males all the time, are they?
No. A theory that's been around a long time is that parasites and diseases are actually driving hen choice, and that cycling in the parasites and disease in the population cause the hens to, through time, select different males or males with different characteristics, because as all the males become resistant to one parasite, another parasite enters the system, and hens now have a new trait or new selection criteria by which to pick males.
Well, how is it that the female sage grouse would keep changing their minds or even know what to look for, whether or not that bird has a parasite or a different disease?
Well, it gets a little dangerous when you start putting things in human terms, but essentially when they enter the lek site, it seems as if they're evaluating each male. So one thing they might be evaluating a male on is the color of his air sacs. So if he has bright yellow air sacs, that indicates that he has the carotenoids or the colorations he needs to make those air sacs. Lots of those colorations might also be important for the immune system. So if he is able to put them into his big, bright air sacs, that might also be an indication of a strong immune system.
So yellow is good.
Yellow is good.
You're now starting a master's project in this. What exactly is your project going to be?
Well, my project is to look at the role of disease in Alberta's population of sage grouse, and specifically with West Nile virus being such an important management issue.
Well, I hope everything works out well for your project. Thank you very much, Jen.
Thanks.
That was Jen Carpenter, a master's student in biological sciences at the University of Alberta. Jen's supervisor is Dr. Mark Boyce. He holds the Alberta Conservation Association Chair in Fisheries and Wildlife, and he's been doing a lot of work on grizzly bears. At a recent public lecture, Mark outlined some of the risks to survival that grizzlies face in Alberta, and he called it a requiem.
Well, a requiem, of course, is the sort of music that one plays at a funeral or a dirge, and is what you would expect if grizzly bears were to go extinct. If we keep on the same trajectory that we have right now with industrial development taking place at an ever-increasing rate, there will be no habitats for grizzly bears on the slopes of Alberta outside of national parks. And so the current trajectories of change for the landscape and associated habitats for grizzly bears are a very dismal prognosis. And any attempt to do a population viability analysis, given what we know about the distribution of mortalities of grizzly bears and the rate at which mortalities have been occurring in the province, the prognosis is not a good one. And a requiem is probably very appropriate.
The issue surrounding grizzly bears and their viability has become a political issue. But what does the science say about whether or not they're threatened?
That's a sticky one, because there are good connections between grizzly bears in Alberta and grizzly bears in British Columbia. And Mike Proctor, who's a postdoc working in my lab, has used DNA evidence to demonstrate that there's substantial movement across the provincial boundary into BC, where there's a very large population of grizzly bears. So whether the bears are truly threatened with extinction, I suppose, is debatable. Certainly the East Slopes landscapes that are being riddled with roads and industrial development are not going to be able to support viable populations of grizzly bears unless some major changes are made in the way in which human access to this network of roads is controlled. So are the bears threatened with extinction? I think we'll probably have bears here at least through my lifetime and probably for the next 100 years, partly because of the close connections with our national parks and British Columbia. Are bears in trouble? They're in big trouble on provincial lands because of industrial development and unbridled road development and access. So it's a matter of, I guess, where in the province one outlines your target of interest. But as it relates to provincial lands, there are many areas in the province where bears are probably in very serious trouble.
One of the things you brought up is that there are a number of different models that try and predict the number of bears and how they survive, but there's a lot of disparity in what the models say. Why is there that disparity in the outcomes and the numbers that they predict?
Well, the different models include different parameters. So in the case of my model, I have what's called density dependence in the model, meaning that as the population increases, we'll see a reduction in fecundity and an increase in mortality that will ultimately lead to a carrying capacity. The other models that we examined didn't even include such a carrying capacity, and thereby there's no connection with habitat whatsoever, which seems pretty naive at the outset to me. In addition, the different models include different corrections for non-reported mortalities, different corrections for wounding loss, different corrections associated with whether bears are translocated. Based on some work that I did in the Yellowstone ecosystem, I found that bears that were translocated for management reasons, I mean, the bears would get into trouble and so they'd be put in a culvert trap and driven a few hundred kilometers and dumped out. Those bears have mortality rates that are three times the mortality rate of bears that are not translocated. So I incorporated that into our revised model as well. So it's a combination of different variables in the models that give us different predictions. But in my opinion, the model that the government used to use is structurally flawed and can't possibly be a useful management tool for grizzly bears in Alberta.
Why is that?
Because it is an exponential growth model, which means that there's no connection whatsoever with the habitat except to anchor the initial population size, and then the population can grow exponentially without bound to infinitely large size, which is totally out of line with reality.
What are other jurisdictions doing to improve the situation for grizzly bears?
Oh, and I would say that there are a number of areas where access management is being used very successfully in Montana, Wyoming, in Idaho, in British Columbia. Access management is used to restrict human access to roads that would put them in the middle of prime grizzly bear habitats. There are sort of mixed reactions to access management. A lot of hunters, for example, recognize how beneficial access management is for elk populations as well. And so you get support from some hunting sectors, and you get objections to it from other hunting sectors when roads are closed, for example, into an area where somebody's been hunting for the last 15 years. They expect to be able to go in there with their pickup truck and camper and be able to go hunting. But so it's easy to understand why, especially locally, we oftentimes get strong resistance to access management. But industry, by and large, has been supportive of the proposals to implement access management.
Why is that?
In the case of forestry, after a road has been used, it could be used again in the next rotation if it's not seriously damaged. So by decommissioning the road, taking out some bridges and minimizing any opportunity for people to have access to those roads. The roads are not disturbed during the spring when they're wet. You don't have the erosion, and the road structure and foundation can remain intact until the next harvest cycle. In the case of oil and gas sector, sometimes vandalism of well sites and pipelines can be a problem, and so having access management reduces the risk of vandalism problems at well sites. So for different reasons, both the forestry and oil and gas sector are oftentimes supportive of various types of access management.
You used that magic word in your talk when you're talking about access management, and that's enforcement, that you can't have one without the other if it's really going to work. Where has enforcement worked?
I had a graduate student, Julie Mao, who wanted me to teach her how to hunt elk. And so we went hunting west of Yellowstone Park in the Centennial Mountains about 3 years ago. And I was very much impressed how the Bureau of Land Management in the United States implemented access management with little tiny signs that were no bigger than 8 by 10 or so that said road closed during certain dates. And they'd have them on a fence post at the beginning of these little two tracks that would go up into the mountains. And we had a fresh snow on opening day of elk season, and you could see that nobody was driving down these roads. And so I asked the local wildlife biologist about that, and he said, well, when they first tried to restrict access in these areas, people just ignored the signs and went driving anywhere, and it was a total chaos. And the access management just wasn't working. But they implemented a sting operation where they went in and nabbed some of the offenders, and there were pictures in the local paper of quads being helicoptered out and reports of violators being fined $5,000 fines for being in areas where road closures were to be in effect, and it worked. People respected those road closures, and you didn't see any tracks of people going down those closed roads. They got the message, and so it didn't take an expensive gate. It just took a little tiny sign, but some enforcement and some knowledge that those access restrictions would be enforced was all that it took.
Can science help us find a way for bears and people to coexist?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, bears are relatively easy, I think, in that context, in that they're omnivorous. They eat just about anything. Forestry is, in general, beneficial to bears by increasing the amount of foods available for bears. A young cut block, an early successional cut block, is excellent habitat for grizzly bears so long as there aren't roads running through the cut block. And so by managing roads, managing access to roads, we can very easily, very economically preserve habitats in the face of industrial development. So I think preserving bears for the long term is largely just a matter of implementing sound access management and identifying and reducing other places where there are conflicts between bears and humans, such as dumps, such as requiring bear-proof garbage cans throughout the prime range of grizzly bears in Alberta. These sorts of things are cheap to implement, require some enforcement, but we can do it very well, very easily, and we'll have bears for the long term.
Is there some way that we should structure our economic development differently in order to accommodate bears?
I don't think that there would be any serious economic consequence to access management. And we could even implement roadless area legislation that protected some of the large blocks of Alberta that still haven't been riddled with roads. So I asked my friend Brad Stelfox to do some calculations on sources of energy for the future of Alberta and where the economic revenues were likely to come from. And using the government's projections of where energy resources exist in Alberta, bitumen development in northeastern Alberta is the prime driver for the future economy of the province. If we were to not build another road anywhere along the east slopes, the consequences to the overall economy of the province would be hardly measurable. So we seem to think that Alberta Advantage has to give free rein to industry to develop anywhere and everywhere they want to, but it's not necessary, and future Albertans will be much richer if we have a few pockets of oil and gas left in the province and the wildlife resources and wilderness associated with those wildlife resources in a few places still. We don't have to ravage all of Alberta's landscapes.
Thank you very much, Mark.
My pleasure.
That was Dr. Mark Boyce. He holds the Alberta Conservation Association Chair in Fisheries and Wildlife at the University of Alberta. Dr. Fiona Schmiglow is supposed to be on sabbatical from her position as an associate professor in renewable resources at the University of Alberta, but her agenda keeps her traveling from east to west and north to south, what with the work she's doing on a NAFTA challenge, boreal conservation, and a book. And then there's the Yukon. I managed to catch up with Fiona when she was in Edmonton recently to give a public lecture on managing development for the benefit of the environment.
Well, I'm working on many of the same things that I've been working on in Alberta for a number of years, but in a slightly different context. The Yukon's in a situation right now where they've got the vast majority of the Yukon territory is relatively pristine, very light human footprint, but there are a lot of development interests and pressures coming down the road, and they're making a lot of land use decisions right now. So it's a very interesting place for me to be because I entered the arena in Alberta at a slightly different stage, and now we have the opportunity there to make some more proactive decisions prior to development instead of trying to sort of scramble back from a less desirable position.
What would be the comparison between the environmental situation in Alberta and what is in the Yukon?
Well, Alberta still has, a lot of ecosystems, particularly in the north, that are still in relatively good condition. But there are also extensive resource tenures on just about, every square inch of Alberta, many of them overlapping. These are themes that you've covered before in previous interviews. The situation in the Yukon Territory is that it's a largely unallocated land base. Now, of course, the First Nations would say that's not true because they've recently settled a lot of land claims. And that's a very interesting situation as well because there have been significant shifts in authority over resources in the last couple of years, also with devolution of the federal government to territorial responsibilities. And so they're at the stage right now where they're actually developing self-government and co-management arrangements with First Nations and the territorial government and developing policy on resource management. And so it's a really interesting place to be working right now and sitting around discussion tables because, the field's kind of wide open. They can decide where they want to go. They're not carrying a lot of baggage in terms of existing policy frameworks.
Where should they be going? What should they be considering?
Well, I think that they should be considering, managing and maintaining the full range of ecological and, in many cases, cultural values that currently exist in the Yukon Territory and beyond. Canadians value the Yukon as being, an incredible wilderness area. And making sure that the decisions that they make in terms of resource allocations don't preclude future opportunities. Because, the bottom line, I think, is that if we were honest about our state of understanding, there's still a huge amount of uncertainty in terms of how we can manage resources such that we can use them as humans. We need to consume resources. We need sustainable economies. But we also want to maintain these other values. And when we make very hasty resource allocation decisions, it does tend to preclude future opportunities or make it a lot more difficult to create a policy environment that's more favorable to including that full range of value with less conflict. So really, I think, they need to think about, the full range of conservation and resource values that are out there right now and make sure that as they make resource allocation decisions that they're maintaining future options so that they don't give the whole farm away at once sort of thing.
Well, looking at the research that you've done personally and then also your colleagues in the development of Alberta's resources and how we deal with environmental concerns, are we moving away from, say, a mitigation mindset towards one that's more friendly to managing and also maintaining what we have?
I think we are, because I think what people are realizing is that the sort of institutional isolation, shall I say, that we've seen historically in Alberta with management of resources on the same area of land being handled by different departments, having multiple industrial agencies operating agents on the same land base with little coordination historically. And now we're seeing much more move towards integrated resource management, coordinated planning, less institutional isolation, although that's a very slow thing to overcome and change. And so this is, you know, where I see incredible opportunity in the Yukon and some of the other jurisdictions in Canada right now that are not quite so far down the line, is that, they have the opportunity from the onset to make sure that they have institutions that are integrated, that they're the right and left hand aren't doing things separately, that obviously have cumulative and additive effects on the landscapes and the values. And so really considering the full range of options and making sure that it's built into the policy environment, the policy and management environment ahead of time. And that's where we're going now in the province of Alberta, and lots of people are working very hard towards that. But it's much more difficult to create those kinds of situations when there's sort of an existing entrenchment in a system.
As you're spreading this message, are you a voice in the wilderness, or do you have some support from your colleagues?
Oh, no, I think I have support from my colleagues here and across Canada, and actually from the international community as well, because when people look at Canada in an international context, they see it as a land of still incredible opportunity. You know, you look south to the U.S. or in a boreal context to Sweden and Finland, or colleagues that I work with in Australia, and they're all, sort of pushed to a point where they're constantly in reactive mode because everything's a crisis all the time, and that's what they're forced to spend their time thinking about and working on. And here they see that we have an opportunity really to show, global leadership in terms of really developing sustainable land use practices. And so that gets people excited, and they're very supportive. And so, no, I don't feel like I'm a voice in the wilderness.
Well, you managed to find some time to give a seminar on some of these issues dealing with crisis or opportunity management. What was your take-home message?
Well, I think my take-home message really was let's be smart about this. Let's not make hasty decisions. Let's recognize that we do have a full range of opportunities that exist in Canada still, that we can be global leaders, that we have made commitments to this at every jurisdictional level, that there are lots of reasons apparent why we should do things differently, and let's just do it.
Thank you very much, Fiona.
Thanks, Cheryl.
That was Dr. Fiona Schmiglow, Associate Professor in the Department of Renewable Resources at the University of Alberta. She's also a researcher with the Sustainable Forest Management Network. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the Sustainable Forest Management Network, the Alberta Conservation Association, the University of Lethbridge, Science Alberta Foundation, iCORT, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, Alberta Ingenuity, Alberta Research Council, Ducks Unlimited Canada, Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, and Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.